Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Welcome to episode 523 with my guest, Dr. Leslie Tate Gould. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the bullshit rattling around in your skull. This show's not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I am not a therapist. I'm struggling to be a human being. Aren't we all? Was that for just a generic sentence to kick the podcast off with? Why don't I talk about the weather? You fucking jackass. I'm doing okay. I am waiting to get an MRI on both of my knees tonight before my doctor comes up with a plan for me to deal with my newly diagnosed rheumatoid arthritis. But I'm living in the future a lot in my head. Sometimes I'll wake up in the morning and I'll just get a jolt of fear going through my body, you know, and it's not so much that I don't have a fear of death as much as I have a fear of suffering and just having a really degraded life. You know, the fact that all of my hobbies involve using my body and using my joints, you know, playing guitar, making furniture, playing hockey. I really hope I can keep doing those things. And then I try to remind myself, you know, I lean on the stuff that I've learned in my support groups. And one of the things that I remind myself is that there are a ton of things in my life that rheumatoid arthritis cannot touch. Love I have with friends, with my girlfriend. That's it. There's nothing more. It's one thing on the list. The rest of it's going to be a shit show. This is from the Happy Moments survey filled out by June, and she writes, the first night sleeping away from my abusive ex-boyfriend in my own apartment, knowing I would never have to sleep under the same roof as him again. High fucking five to you, June. You know, I have no personal experience knowing what that is like, but from the things I've read and the people I've talked to, it is really hard sometimes mentally to leave somebody who's abusive because there can be good qualities to them. And a lot of times they've dug their hooks in emotionally and they're good at manipulating and apologizing, or you feel stuck, you know, financially. But I just want to give you a high five. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a gender fluid person who calls himself blood in my caffeine stream. And they write, when my near manic mental illness happy hour accompanied cleaning spree turns into what seems like a deep friend talk session between Paul, the guest, and I. And before I know it, my long neglected bathroom is clean. I have some self-revelation done and I realize I am still very codependent and I'm not utterly crushed by that revelation, but excited to work on it to see how much better my life can get. Holy run-on sentence. That's what I get for Adderall and coffee. I have to say, if you're going to do a run-on sentence, that one was pretty beautiful. Now, it was easy to read. A lot of times the run-on sentences, you know, people won't use punctuation. And even if I've read it before I read it on the podcast, I'll just get flummoxed. But thank you for that. I'm glad I helped you clean your bathroom. And what I take away from this moment you shared is that when you see shit stains, you think of me. Is that the wrong takeaway? We are sponsored today, as always, by the online therapy provider, BetterHelp.com. That's help, H-E-L-P, BetterHelp.com. If you want to try it, go to BetterHelp.com/mental and make sure you include the slash metal part so that they know that you came from the podcast and continue to advertise with us. They're a big part of what helps keep us afloat. So go try it out. I'm a big, big fan of online therapy, especially my therapist, Donna, who I am scheduled to see again soon. I definitely need a tune-up. I have not made an appointment lately, and I can feel that there's stuff that I need to talk about. And a lot of times I don't even realize that there's stuff that I needed to talk about until I start talking about it. And I think that's one of the great things about therapy. And it's certainly nice not having to leave your house to do it. So go to betterhelp.com/metal, fill out a questionnaire. And if they have a counselor that they feel is a good fit for you, they'll match you up with one and you can experience a free week of counseling. You need to be 18 and they're licensed in all 50 states. All right, one more sentence. This is actually just a snapshot from Struggle in a Sentence. I know, oh shit, I don't have the person's name that filled this out. But she writes a snapshot from her life, and she deals with depression, ADHD, food issues, and anger issues. Trying to convince myself that my ponytail masks the fact that I haven't washed my hair in a week because showering seems overwhelming and getting naked seems cold and water seems like too much touching me. All while getting dressed for my job as an attorney.
I just wanted to get the fuck away from my life.
You know, I couldn't have felt any lower.
Grief, guilt, shame.
Why wasn't I born a girl?
There's a switch that gets flipped in my head.
I'm supposed to be a girl.
I experience being treated like an animal.
How can a just God...
I have a vomit fetish.
...let humans do this to each other?
Help!
I fucking flew over the cuckoo's nest.
My wife's losing it.
I thought it was all about me.
I don't know what to do.
I would have committed suicide if I could have watched my funeral.
A Polaroid I found of my mother, naked in a dentist chair.
And my body doesn't quite...
I think I did 8 days in L.A. County Jail.
...fit how I see myself.
What was it all for? Why are my friends dead?
Everything that I did...
There's a comfort in the scars for me.
...was in service of OCD.
You've already had all the paper cuts. Step away from the paper.
It's really hard to see the picture when you're inside the frame.
You know, it takes a larger view to see your life.
Just actually have somebody listen to you.
Yeah. And I got up and got my tooth and left.
I am here with Dr. Leslie Tate Gould. You have your doctorate in psychology. You're a clinician, and your specialty is integrative. You would say integrating different modalities of therapy.
Yes, because
or that's your wheelhouse. I mean, don't let me put words in your mouth.
Sure. So. I would say that I specialize in treating mood disturbances and trauma-related disorders from an integrative model. So I became certified as a somatic experiencing practitioner back in 2017. And from there, you know, in, you know, kind of my own evolution as a psychotherapist, but also in the development and running of a business, which is, you know, mine and several other owners, Lido Wellness Center, we really work on establishing and really having a lot of intention behind integrative models to heal and support people through their healing journey from trauma and mood disturbances.
What do you mean when you say have intention?
I mean that in order to get some of these services off the ground and have them be delivered in such a way that it's not, you know, woo-woo, and it's not, you know, so missing the mark as far as like really meeting somebody where they're at. So it's really taking services that are integrating the nervous system, integrating kind of all parts of what I believe is like, you know, part of, you know, profound healing. You know, you have to integrate the emotional aspects, the cognitive aspects, the spiritual aspects,
the body,
the physical aspects. So and that's what I mean by kind of having a lot of intention behind that integration. So, you know, for myself, that might be through utilizing somatic experiencing in session work, but it's also utilizing a lot of other modalities, right? Like we were, you know, chatting before we jumped on, my traditional training is in cognitive behavioral therapy. So I'm definitely familiar with what I, you know, refer to as top-down approaches, you know.
Yeah. Would it be fair to say that somatic experiencing helps release trauma that's trapped in the body?
I think that, how do I answer that? Because I think that
why don't you explain what somatic, instead of an amateur
sure,
trying to describe what it is to the listener?
Sure, sure. So, you know, the language of somatic experiencing is that it's the experience of the nervous system of the body. Why I sometimes struggle with the language as far as something being trapped in the body, there is evidence sometimes to suggest that that's possible. But what I also know is trauma is really ambiguous and it's very relative. And so sometimes we'll see, you know, kind of an experience of some symptomatology that might suggest that there was unresolved trauma, but they might not actually have the conscious awareness of something like happening within their system, right? It might just be their relationships are, you know, going, you know, and taking a left turn. They're having a lot of addictive, you know, patterns in their behavior. So if I too quickly might, you know, even though in my expertise, I might see something that might, you know, be consistent with like some type of, you know, trauma kind of, you know, resonating within a nervous system. If I leap there too quickly, it might risk kind of being misunderstood by a patient. So I tend to, you know, when I'm incorporating something like somatic experiencing in, it's really playing to a lot of what people already have the awareness of. So for instance, like I specialize in treating men and women struggling with disordered eating, and whether or not they meet the diagnostic, you know, criteria for that is not so much of the issue. But often where there has been historical attachment injuries or trauma, there's often a very kind of interesting and unique relationship to food. So I might take some of those behavioral routes before kind of linking them more like innately and intuitively into like what's actually happening within their system. Cause I find that like, especially in that type of population, if I'm too quickly, you know, kind of doing some deep diving into some body work, they'll never come back to my office, you
right.
know? So then I'll play to like different strengths. So, you know, sometimes, and that's where I think my former training in cognitive behavioral therapy really lends itself nicely, because I can play to a strength of like incorporating in kind of the thought piece and sometimes where those thoughts become irrational or what we might call disturbed, to have that be a vehicle through where I can get maybe closer to what might be manifesting in the nervous system. I'm also really sensitive when you're working with trauma and folks that might have experienced, you know, an event that we might categorize as traumatic. Mm-hmm. I'm also quite sensitive in even using certain words and referring to, you know, the body in a certain way. So you've probably even, you know, caught on, I'll refer to the body as a nervous system or a structure. I've even invited some of my patients to even, you know, share with me what language they would prefer when you're, you know, trying to kind of get near some of that work that can really manifest, as we, you know, and as we understand from, you know, Peter Levine's work, Bessel van der Kolk's work. But sometimes like on a clinical practice level, it's it takes time, you know, yeah. It takes time to really get near that. So I guess that also in some ways refers to even the first question of the intention that I take and also my team takes at Lido Wellness. Like, we take a lot of intention at doing things that are paced. So we're not, you know, deep diving. We're not looking for cathartic, you know, big revelatory right. releases.
The order is as important as, you know, whatever the issue is that you're looking to kind of, I don't know, heal.
Absolutely. You know, at Lido Wellness, because we are an outpatient clinic, so we do treat at times like a higher acute patient, you know, somebody who maybe has even taken some time out from their lives and has gone to maybe away for treatment, you know, has gone to residential, and we're kind of acting as a bridge before they kind of resume back into normal daily routine and functioning, maybe with their parents or their work life. So we really have to be cautious around what areas that we're, you know, willing to start unpacking. Mm-hmm. And I know for myself, like, I'll even have patients sometimes come in for an initial assessment and they'll say, okay, Dr. Tate, like, I know I need to work on this. But then anytime in session work, if we start to get near it, they become highly dysregulated. Mm-hmm. Like, I may, you know, again, like, trying to be as attuned as possible, I may, you know, suggest, hey, like, maybe we need to kind of go a different route. But the pacing is everything. Because sometimes
when you say dysregulated, it's too heavy for them?
Not necessarily too heavy. In fact, my experience of when people can find themselves in a pattern of dysregulation, it's often they've actually kind of reinforced that pattern in which they can actually talk about like really, really upsetting, you know, kind of terrifying descriptions of maybe some former events or some things mm-hmm. that have happened. But it's more there. What I mean kind of by that dysregulation is there's not a way for them to integrate some of that material to either like find some deep meaning or purpose with it, to find some way to kind of move forward from it or let go of it. So it almost kind of becomes like this recursive, like recurrent, you know, constriction. And so when we're talking about, you know, pacing and also, you know, things being too heavy, I tend to, and I say I, but a lot of somatic experiencing practitioners tend to really look at, you know, what's kind of happening unconsciously, what's maybe being missed in their conscious awareness. And we are also really highly skilled to look at, right as somebody's sitting across from us in the room, what are some of those behaviors? What are those mannerisms that might be showing us that, okay, this person is doing this very gesture or is seated in such a way that might be actually more supportive? So we're going to like look there. Like, we're going to kind of let the body kind of take us to, okay, gosh, when they talk about this topic, you know, sometimes their like leg stops shaking. So we might just bring some gentle awareness, like, hey, I noticed that as you've been talking about that, your leg kind of went still. Can you notice what that stillness feels like? Or mm-hmm. how do you experience it to be there? Or does it, you know, kind of remind you of something, right? So we might pace it and slow things down in such a way where there's not so much emphasis on the details. You know, there's a lot more emphasis on how can we kind of slow it down? How can we be curious? Mm-hmm.
Mindfulness is a big part of
huge part.
Starting it. As I've shared with the listeners before, I did somatic experiencing about 2 years ago, and I think I did about 10 sessions, and I was very skeptical in the beginning because it felt very woo-woo yes. to me. You know, the practitioner, who was awesome, was very into New Age stuff. There was candles and the Buddhist altar, and some of the language she used was not language that I necessarily would use. In fact, it would sometimes be the language of people that I would kind of make fun of. Even though I know it probably worked for them, I hung in there because I'm willing to try anything. And at about the sixth session, something broke open wide in me. And I suddenly understood the power of this mm-hmm. because I was that 10-year-old laying on the table, terrified that nobody was going to help him. And she was there saying, I'm right here. Mm-hmm. You're right here. You're safe. And it sounds kind of silly to say these things because they sound so obvious. why is it that there's that disconnect between the intellectual and the emotional, that somatic experiencing might be needed for someone? I felt such a release afterwards.
Well, there's a few different directions I could take that question. One, and what came up kind of just organically for me, is that my experience is that the disconnect is, and perhaps it's not even a disconnect. Perhaps it's actually just kind of what is reinforced, what is attended to, and what is at times required in some of the ways and environments in which we're raised. So, because not only, you know, is my former experience in cognitive behavioral therapy, but once I really started to deep dive into somatic work and really kind of taking my practice in a completely different direction to really specialize in trauma, when you're looking into trauma, you're also looking at attachment. You're looking at those fundamental developmental milestones in relationships and that tending to, you know, what's happening for that little being that is developing.
So trust is definitely an issue that you have to look at.
Huge, huge trust. I've known that in my own experience, even the ability to have different tones in our voice, right? Mm-hmm. Where sometimes if I'm working with a particular patient in which we've had a long history, there's a long established relationship, there's a lot of trust, you know, there, I can maybe go in a different direction with that patient as opposed to someone who I'm just meeting for the first time, who I'm really having to kind of lay the framework and the modeling for what a safe, trusting, like aligning relationship can even begin to look and sound like.
Yeah, that makes sense for me because in my experience, the first six sessions were a lot of her just saying, you know, notice the sound of the traffic outside. Notice the color of the sky. You know, what is a sound or moment from your life that has fond memories attached to it? You know, bring that feeling in here right now.
Yes.
And it felt in a lot of ways like, oh my God, how long are we going to do this? But I did begin to notice session after session, I began to feel, safer with her. Not that I ever felt unsafe, but there begins to be this, for lack of a better word, bond. And I understood afterwards, oh, this was necessary for that little kid in me to feel safe enough to say the words that he was afraid to say when he felt like he wasn't safe.
Well, what you just described, maybe without even knowing it, is a real kind of foundational approach, or I guess you would call it a technique in somatic experiencing that a lot of practitioners use and just live by, which is orientation. And, you know, orientation is not new on the scene. You know, we do this naturally. We do this unconsciously on the day-to-day basis. It's how we know kind of our way around new environments. It's why when we walk into a new setting like this, I noticed myself, because I'm familiar with this framework of orientation, that as I sat right, you know, in this chair, as I was waiting for you to get started, I looked around, right? I let my eyes kind of go around to see what books you read, to see what's on the wall. That allows our systems to feel kind of more secure. And most certainly, if we've had an experience in which our physical proximity and our integrity has been compromised, we're going to even do that times a thousand, right? And that's where at times it can turn into more of a hypervigilance, right? Where patients will say, I know exactly where every door is, every window is in every single new environment I'm in. And so what you just described, though, is that we want to start bridging that natural unconscious process and bring kind of some of the goodness, those supportive references into our conscious awareness. So what I do, and again, I kind of pace this with every new person that I meet in a clinical setting. Sometimes patients are really gung-ho on this type of style of, in, you know, really utilizing this technique of orientation. Maybe they've done mindfulness exercises before. They've done meditation. So they have a lot more comfortability of, let your eyes just kind of go around and let them, you know, let them bring in supportive imagery from the past. Let them bring in, you know, kind of to build some of that robustness of, you know, kind of boosting that system, if you will. So then when we're ready to kind of head into some more tricky terrain, it's already got support. But sometimes patients, you know, and I can kind of feel and sense that mm-hmm. pretty quickly. Sometimes if I go into that direction, it can kind of kick up what we call like that self-protection, right? Yeah. So it can kick up that like, what is this? And is this BS? Or, you know, like, right. what is she asking me to do? And so then I might go in a different direction, right? I might mm-hmm. weave in, you know, okay, well, this person might be actually more comfortable with like top-down processing. So we're going to stay in thoughts for a little bit longer. Yeah. You know, because there's also a way in which we can orient and our thoughts can be either supportive or really undermining, right?
Yeah.
So we can kind of play around with thoughts, because if that's a channel that they speak more fluently, then I'm going to start there to really be building that rapport, to mm-hmm. be building that kind of trusting, aligning, you know, relationship to prepare us for if like when we need to do some deeping dive later.
One of the things that she focused on a lot was sensing where I was holding tension in my body, and would kind of encourage me to, you know, bring my attention to that and to let it go, whether it was my brow that was furrowed or my chest looked kind of tight or I was clenching my fists. And the first six sessions were a lot of that. And I did begin to slowly relax more and more and more. And then one day it just like an apparition appearing in the doorway. It just was suddenly there. And all of these intense feelings came up. And half of my brain was witnessing it and saying, I'm so glad something is happening. And the other part of me was that little kid who was terrified, who felt like nobody was going to come save him. And I didn't have the words when I was that kid. But having the words then, it felt almost like steam being released, like all of this pressure that had been there forever, like sadness and you know, wanting to scream, I'm so afraid, come help me. You know, those were the things I suddenly found myself saying. And it wasn't coming from an intellectual place. It was just, it was right there. And I'm curious about how it is that when you're dealing with a patient, you've talked a bit about meeting them when they're there. I would love to hear an example of what you actually do physically, things that you actually say when you're doing somatic experiencing with a patient. If you could, with confidentiality in mind, sure. give us an example, real life vignettes from your work to better kind of highlight.
Sure. So let me think, because again, I have to be very cautious, right?
Right.
In just what I, you know, would be willing to bring into a setting like this in, you know, the honoring of that confidentiality and protection of privacy. I mean, so one thing that you mentioned about your experience is you mentioned a table. So it sounds like your practitioner also was, you know, probably very advanced in body work.
Yeah, she also had her license as a massage therapist. So she was licensed to touch me, to lay her hands on me.
Right.
Not in like a, you know, I don't know, not in like a faith healing way,
for sure,
but in a way to say, here is a safe touch.
Mm-hmm.
Here is, you are rooted. Somebody here is safe, who is with you, and you can trust me.
Absolutely. Well, and the reason I asked was because, you know, when I went through my certification, which for those that don't know, it's 3 years. And I did not know that when I signed on.
For somatic experiencing.
And that was so foreign to me, because in my history of being trained and, you know, kind of doing kind of more advanced certifications, it's usually a long weekend, right? And you get some skills and you get some information, and then you go and you're able to incorporate those into your practice. This was so vastly different, because what I really discovered was, you know, not only did they pace the trainings, and that there was a lot of intention behind that, as far as we would meet for a long weekend, and then there'd be about 3 to 4 months in between, because not only were we being trained of how to bring this modality to our patients, but we also were required to do our own sessions. And so some of, you know, the moving and, you know, mm-hmm. and what you were describing, what we'll refer to sometimes in session work as like kind of emotional discharge, mm-hmm. that there's like actually like energy moving through the system. And it, and sometimes it can be felt through heat. Sometimes it can be felt through sweat. Sometimes it can be felt through tears, right? Mm-hmm. Like that there's actually like kind of physiological changes that are happening in the system to reflect some of those really intense shifts that, that can occur from trauma resolution. So in some of like bringing some of that material back to sessions, I had to really kind of hold my former experience as a more traditionally trained psychotherapist and also kind of look at what type of patient am I working with? And where do I see this kind of unfolding as far as my comfortability with doing like, touch work and body work? So my advanced sessions, we actually had to undergo, right, as, you know, part of our training, not only kind of undergoing sessions in which, you know, people were able to do touch work for us, but then we also had to practice. And it was the very awkward, you know, you'd be in like a triad and you'd have to be, you know, very clumsily, like, you know, trying not to do harm, you know, mm-hmm. to the person that you're working with. But, you know, safe touch, and there's a lot of exceptional SEs who actually incorporate this like on a daily basis in their work. It is a tremendous kind of part that can really coincide with some of the depths that this, you know, kind of model can take people. I, for myself, since I had to really negotiate that as a clinical psychologist, I don't utilize touch nearly as often as some of, you know, my other SE comrades.
Do you have an additional license to be able to touch?
There is a few additional certifications, but they're not necessarily from like the institute in which I became certified. So they're not from like the SETI organization. But there is, you know, there's a few, you know, kind of champions who have really made that more of their kind of level of expertise. Mm-hmm. And I've considered, you know, taking some of their courses because I know the healing benefits of it. In fact, in a former life, I worked in, you know, primary residential settings, specializing in treating substance addictions. Mm-hmm. And I used to anecdotally say, and maybe there's a published article out there that supports this, but I used to say, especially for my, you know, the ones that I would love, my heroin addicts and my opiate addicts, that this to me was a fundamental demonstration of a lack of safe touch throughout their lives.
Yeah.
And anecdotally, that was really confirmed for me because we would talk about what the highs would provide for them. And it was a warm blanket. You know, mm-hmm. a warm, soothing, gentle caress, right? That was missing from their life. And so there is a tremendous healing value to being able to incorporate safe touch into practice. And once in a while with, you know, especially my private practice, when I've worked with someone for many years, I might do some things. For instance, because you were asking kind of what are the tools? You know, one thing that I've done from time to time, and it's a really powerful exercise, is you can sometimes have a patient seated and it's kind of, you have to be really strategic because you also have to make sure that you're comfortable and not in the sense of like a boundary or anything, but more just because sometimes you do touch holds for like several minutes. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure you're comfortable and seated in a way in which you're not going to crink your neck or anything. But I've invited patients to be looking out of a window so that they have a really supportive, you know, area in which they can orient. And then I've had, basically it's a postural hold. So I'll be seated behind them with their permission, of course, and I'll do kind of a gentle kind of, snug. So my arms or my hands will go on either side of their arms. Mm-hmm. So it almost looks kind of like a half hug,
right.
But it's from behind, and I'll just, you know, kind of my hands will be there. There will be enough pressure so that they know that they're there. That's also mm-hmm. really important.
And are they seated or on a table?
They're seated.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're seated in a chair. I'm seated, you know, kind of mm-hmm. Behind them, but off to the side a little bit so that they can also kind of, if they need to, I can kind of see also what's happening more clearly. And then I'll just be, you know, kind of inviting them to breathe. So where that has been really powerful is with some of my patient work, for those that might be struggling more with panic presentation, where there can kind of almost be through that touch, a series of kind of diaphragmatic breaths, supportive breaths that we can kind of get in a pattern together. So it can really help to foster kind of a more direct mirroring mm-hmm. of breathing and kind of slowing that posture. it can also help me get a real kind of like literally hands-on feel for what are some of those little supportive behaviors that then I want to highlight and bring some awareness to in session. So, because what happens a lot of times, and we don't really feel it unless someone is like trained to really see it for us, is there's a lot of different sways and different movements that our bodies have. And that when we're given permission with safety to kind of just like let our body move, a lot of times it'll sway from left to right, or it'll sway backwards to forward. And it's not anything violent or anything that you could see. A lot of times, like our untrained eyes, we miss it. You know, a lot of the time where our eyes are more trained to see kind of more of those recurrent or repetitive behaviors, right? The shaking leg to indicate some form of, you know, tension or anxiety. And so sometimes with that touch work, you can even start to like with the patient, like, okay, do you notice that swaying? I'm noticing it too, right?
Right.
So that's kind of a more explicit, if you will, like kind of technique that I've used. But again, a handful of times because it's pretty rare.
One of the things that my practitioner did is she would ask me to focus on my breathing, and she was had her hand on my forearm, and she would gently squeeze it to the rhythm of my breath. And it at first I was like, what the fuck is this? And then I began to feel like, oh, there's somebody here who is completely attuned to me, that has boundaries, that I can really let go. Because I think a lot of us, especially those of us who have had trauma, is we're afraid of the ugly cry. We're afraid that if we start to let go, it's going to be embarrassing. And I came right to that edge with her that one day, and I decided, let's just let it go. Let's just let it go. And I was not only sobbing, I was wailing like a child. And I leaned into it, even though a part of my brain was like, wow, you look really stupid right now. And it made sense to me afterwards why she had six sessions of establishing the trust and no judgment. And is that common, that someone's experience?
You know, it's hard to say because, you know, especially in my time at Lido, often my experience of those that have maybe had former somatic experiencing, it might have been like in a treatment environment. And so what I also know, which can kind of be the blessing and the curse of like a residential treatment experience, is that it's very short term. So sometimes I've, you know, kind of had patients relay that they've had somatic experiencing, but then when they kind of retell it to me, in my professional opinion, it seems a bit quick paced, right? It seems a bit kind of maybe with like a bit too much agenda in motion of we've got to get to this target rather than sitting back and kind of letting things unfold. And, you know, truth be told, like that is where I reside as a therapist. And sometimes with patients, it can be quite frustrating, right? Because they can come in, they're like, I'm ready. I want to work on this. I'm committed. Let's do this. And then we start talking and the pace doesn't feel right. You know, it feels too, you know, kind of focused and quick and potentially could reinforce some of that kind of big swing of catharsis, which does feel good. But then it's what I really took away from a lot of my training in SC was that we have to start moving away from those traditional models that are actually reinforcing our systems to feel bad in order to feel good. Like that is a time and true kind of basically paradigm, you know.
Would it be fair to say that the body lets go when it's ready?
Yes. Because where I have been so humbly in witness to is that in somatic work, in trauma work, we in old times, right, in my old training, I would sometimes view some of the things that would come out of patients' mouths or some of the things that would occur in session as resistance. I know that I was dead wrong back then. Because what I also know is there is such a unique capacity of our body to take that system where it needs and wants to go, and also to have an innate and preserving self-protection in place. And so you even spoke about that, right? Those parts of you that were like, wow, I'm really, you know, I'm leaning into this. I'm ready to let go. And then there was that other, you know, which I might in this case, like title mm-hmm. self-protection, that self-protective part that was like, oh man, like you're going to look real bad. Right. Right. And like, we've got to kind of rein this in and, you know, boy, like we don't really want to lose it. And is it safe to, right? And so we all have kind of those unique characteristics. And what I've really discovered, because another technique that I'll use, I would say I use this every single day in my practice, is there's a channel in which trauma can really kind of manifest and or heal, and that's through imagery. And so when I was first trained in SE, we would really kind of practice what are some supportive images that we can kind of really weave in to see where this kind of trauma renegotiation can lead.
Things that are soothing to people from their past, or just things kind of in general, or all of the above?
All of the above.
And so it might be a, you know, a sunset.
Yeah. And what I, and why I bring this in so often is that I tend to trust that whatever's coming in the room is real and valid and probably important for me to see. And that's a real paradigm shift, right? Especially from like a top-down CBT former therapist mm-hmm. who said, hey, we've got to challenge these thoughts and we've got to, you know, right. have this order and we've got to have this goal in mind. With SE, I sit back and I say, okay, where is this going to take us, right? And sometimes I'm explicit about that, but then sometimes I just kind of see where we're going to go. But as I was mentioning before, that can at times infuriate patients, right? Because they can at times view that as we're not getting to the work.
Yes. Right? And I totally understand that, because there was a part of me that began to feel like she is a charlatan and she is bilking me for
mm-hmm.
money.
Mm-hmm. And so what I really try to assure people of is that in the spirit of like a lot of my work, it appears like chit chat, right? It appears like this like back and forth exchange. But I am carefully looking at and kind of trying to kind of observe what can I weave in as like in what I call like an organic intelligence. And that's not my term. It's, you know, termed from some of the leaders of SE. What's coming into the room that then I can grab onto that might be an actual linkage to where we need to go. The body does that for us. So for instance, at times when I've had, you know, patients where there's maybe been an interruption, and when I say maybe, I should even rephrase that as, for trauma to reside, there is often an interruption of a natural cycle of fight, flight, or freeze. That's where we get stuck. And a lot of times, because we are so evolved and we have these thinking brains, we have these memories, you know, storage facilities in our brains. A lot of times when I've had patients where they'll come in and they'll say, but that thing, like, I should have been able to get away, or I should have been able to fight this person off, or like, what the hell's the matter with me? Like, why did I tolerate that happening? And so in that type of language, right, we really try to kind of shift from that which can feel like helpless. It can feel powerless. It can feel like, you know,
shameful.
Perpetual shame, victimhood. I try to kind of like, you know, bring in another piece of somatic experiencing, which is really the fundamental understanding of our physiology. And so I do a lot of education around what happens in fight, flight, and what is freeze? Why does it come on? You know, I have lectures on dissociation, right? We talk about, you know, there's a whole continuum of dissociation and why at times it comes on to manage that which is unendurable. And that's Levine's work, right? Mm-hmm. He really spoke about this. If you've ever read Waking the Tiger, he's a great section on dissociation. So some of my work will also be, you know, we might be talking about nothing, right? It might just look mm-hmm. like we're talking about grocery lists. But if I'm noticing something happening in their physiology, I might say, hey, like, let's pay attention to that. Just, you know, and sometimes that'll kick up self-protection. Somebody will say, what are you noticing? Right. Right. Or, you know, what is it that you want me to do? You want me to move my hand from here to here? What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Right. And that makes sense. And I really normalize that for patients as well. Like, hey, some of the things that I'm going to ask you to kind of pay attention to, the moment might pass, and that's mm-hmm. okay. Right. Because I also really try to align them and really normalize for them. Look, I'm going to actually be inviting you to, you know, look at these things. But if that system is not ready to look at it and it blasts us off into a different direction, or if it says, you know, nope, now the moment has passed, then I'm going to trust that as an organic, intelligent experience, and I might move in a different direction.
I gotcha. One of the things that I have struggled with when it comes to you know, either talk therapy or somatic experiencing is not being able to describe what I'm feeling, not knowing. Is that a common thing?
Very, very common.
Talk about that.
So in my training and some of my lectures that I'll offer to groups, I refer to an idea. It's an acronym, because you can't have any good therapy model without great acronyms,
sure.
Right? So in somatic work, it's called CYBAM. So it stands for sensation, image, behaviors, affect, aka feelings, or meaning, also known as thoughts, right? So I really try to inform people from this acronym to let them know that each of us have channels that we're really functional at. Sometimes I refer to them as like our superpower, and then other channels that are a little harder for us, that are harder for us to kind of find the language. And it's so interesting, because in my early work in training, I assumed, being a psychologist, that my superpowers were thought and affect. So thoughts and emotions. Because I thought, okay, I'm a psychologist. That's what I do all day.
Right.
I talk thoughts, I talk feelings. Little did I know that when given the permission to actually kind of sit back and just be in the noticing of what's happening in my structure, what's happening where I notice temperature changes, where I notice tightness or looseness, where I notice hunger or fullness, right? Like all of those little kind of nuanced things within my my being.
Oh, you're talking about within you, not within the client. Okay.
Oh, yeah. So, because when I was training, I assumed that, that sensation, I was like, ooh, I don't know. That's why I'm here, right? I'm trying to learn the language of this. I actually discovered that that is my superpower. It's through sensation. And where I've been able to really kind of, pull that into session work is at times really bringing my subjective experience of something into the room and making it live. So for instance, say I'm having a bit of a stuck moment, and I'll just say, like, gosh, what's flashing? And I'll call it like my marquee. I'll be like, what's flashing in my marquee in my mind right now is like, I'm just noticing like something here. And I'm motioning for listeners to my chest. And they'll say, gosh, like, I noticed something too. All right. Like, so let's mutually together kind of pay attention to what we're noticing there. And then, I might invite some orientation. So, because also our tendency, right, when somebody's asking us to, kind of deep dive into our structure, our tendency is to be self-protective, of course, especially if there's been a violation. So I'll weave in, okay, well, while we're doing that, we don't have to hold eye contact. Let's just kind of let our eyes bat around the room and see what we notice, right? Mm-hmm. And so we also refer to that, like in our work, as titration. So we'll be looking outside, right? We'll look at the sky. We'll look at the plants in my office. We'll look at the books on my shelf. And then we'll kind of welcome back what's happening inside. So I'll use that at times to also kind of bring in sometimes that gap that happens when people are like, I just don't have the words. I'll bring in that language of CYBAM. Okay, well, where would you feel like you often do have the words? Well, I can hang in thoughts all day long. Great. Let's start there, right? Mm-hmm. Because thoughts can sometimes lead to a lot of really interesting conversation, of course. It's very intuitive, right? A lot of times our thoughts are, kind of our powerhouse for critical thinking. But when we're trying to kind of navigate the like unsteady seas of trauma, like we have to sometimes be able to kind of, step out into our feeling, awareness, and also our sensations. But I like to kind of go back and forth. I like to maybe go in a channel that's really nuanced, really comfortable, really safe for that person. And then I might dip a toe into like, okay, well, so let's slow that down. Like, wow, I noticed you took a breath there. Like, how did that feel?
Mm-hmm.
To bring in kind of that permission to also notice, hey, something else was showing up in the room with us in addition to some of those thoughts or elsewhere.
And have you experienced this when you were receiving a somatic experiencing, sharing thoughts that were coming up in your head that were kind of stuck and bouncing around? And was that ever embarrassing for you to share those? Or have your patients, shared stuff that was difficult for them to share?
I mean, no doubt, I'll take the first part of the question, What's really nice about the intention that the training takes with somatic experiencing is there's pretty much a built-in expectation that you're going to be with the same group of people for the first 2 years. So you start to really feel out who do I feel safe doing some of these sessions with? And also, and that might be like from peer to peer, but also what practitioners do I really feel safe working with? And so I started to really quickly discern, you know, who do I want to do this work with and who's not for me?
So you had a choice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And then for the latter, you know, question, I mean, no doubt, you know, therapists, like, we have such a privileged experience, and I'm so honored to be able to bear witness to some of the discoveries that people make in my office. You know, people come into our clinic and they'll maybe have even had 45 days or 60 days or 5 years of therapy, and they'll come in and after, you know, some weeks, and I'm not suggesting that it's because we're some, you know, magical wizards in what we do, but I think there's just a lot of permission granted and a lot of space where people will say, gosh, like, I've never even shared this with my husband, mm-hmm. you know, or I've never even shared this, you know, with my therapist whom I've worked with and I really like, yeah. you know. And that's where I really feel like the wisdom in utilizing our body, utilizing the intuition that we have, whether that's through like the intuitive nature of our feelings, you know, our feelings are there to be felt. They are like our temperature gauge of what's happening. What am I noticing? Mm-hmm. And so often, we're in environments or we're required to really compartmentalize those, you know, oh gosh, like I've got such a busy schedule. Like I've got to ignore the fact that I haven't eaten since 7 a.m. and it's 5 p.m. Like that's a problem, you yeah. know, because then we're essentially unintentionally cutting off access to all of the wealth of this information, these channels, these kind of nuances and discoveries that really do reside within us.
Our bodies can be such good friends to us. And it took me decades to understand that because my body always felt like my enemy. Mm. And it felt like it was always working against me, whether it was, you know, that I was tired, or that, you know, some shameful episode from something that turned me on. It, once I stopped judging my body, and started listening to it and stopped numbing it with drugs and alcohol, I began to discover that it was telling me really important things like, you don't like this person.
Right.
This person gives you a stomachache.
Right.
They drain the life out of you. So now, what are you going to do with that information?
Right.
Are you going to take care of yourself, or are you going to be mean and say, you know, you're a terrible son, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And that was a real turning point for me. And to anybody who's out there, who's struggling with body image and, you know, or whatever it is, trapped trauma, chronic pain, just for a moment, say, what if my body is trying to work with me?
Yes. It's so intuitive, and it's the only one we have.
Yeah.
And I mean, you said that so well because, you know, what I tend to see is symptomatically things present themselves for a reason, right? Panic disorder does not just come online for nothing, right? It's a real thing, and it's really scary. You know, I have the utmost compassion and respect for the patients in my life who have had to struggle with that. And in somatic work, we really try to invite in patients to start to get near some of the nuances of what their system is telling them so that they don't have to continue to kind of essentially get awakened when things are so loud and so dysregulated that they can't ignore it any longer.
Yeah.
And so, you know, some frameworks call that like staying within our window of tolerance, right? Mm-hmm. Like we really try to like kind of operate from this window of, okay, I'm noticing like an uptick in nervousness. I'm noticing an uptick in frustration. Like, all right, rather than, like you said, judging that or diminishing it or saying that it's not real or not allowed, right? Because that's often other people's voices, right?
How important is it to deal with someone's numbing themselves through self-medicating before you can make any headway with these other things? Because in my experience, I had to stop numbing my body, as I said, to be able to listen to it.
Yes.
What do you do? Let's say you get somebody who's in there and they're smoking weed all day long. You know, not that weed can't be a great thing for recreational fun, but when somebody's using it to cope with life.
Right. Yeah, I mean, to answer it quickly, but then I'll give a little bit of a longer response. You cannot do them at the same time, because what is required is attending, is, you know, noticing the subtle changes. And when there is kind of a blanket substance that basically targets all areas, all detectors, all of those signals in our system, then there's no way that we can extrapolate what we want to look at, right, and then leave what we don't. So at Lido, you know, we require, even if someone does not identify as having a substance use disorder or an issue with alcohol or drugs, we do require that people remain chemically abstinent, other than what might be, you know, kind of their psychotropic medications that are carefully curated and managed by our medical director, because we know the heavy lifting that is required to do this work. And we also hope that people have kind of the courageous, you know, trust and awareness that, hey, like, you might actually discover that you have what it takes also,
right,
to navigate through this. And that perhaps in the past, when, you know, drugs and alcohol might have come online, things might have been different. Maybe you didn't have that awareness that you really have what it takes. You know, substance abuse and also food-related behavior start young. You know, I tend to see food-related behavior starting around 5, you know, 5, 6, 7. Those are formative years in which people are starting to negotiate and change their relationship to food in order to seek out comfort, in order to seek out at times distraction or numbness. So what I also know and greatly respect about this work is I also know that I cannot sweep in and take people's resources until we also arm them and offer them solutions that won't have the kind of the same harmful outcomes.
And I loved how you described that. One of the support groups that I started going to years after I had been sober, because I was still struggling with intimacy and the ability to trust, one of the things that I discovered in this support group was that this was not a program of deprivation. This was a program of healthy abundance. This was just about, you know, switching chairs.
Yes, absolutely. And I like that you use that word abundance, because a lot of what my kind of foundational work with anyone that I'm doing, like, very traditional SE with, is where can we kind of orient toward generating greater access to pleasure, but safe pleasure, right?
Going for a hike, learning how to draw, spending time with friends, going to a movie by yourself.
Right. So genuine kind of what someone actually referred to, and I loved this, wholesome pleasure, right? Yeah. Where there's no strings attached, you don't wake up and there's any regrets the next day, where it just actually feels good. It's nourishing to your system. Because what I also know is, you know, depending on kind of what the challenges, you know, somebody has faced, whether before maybe the introduction of numbing agents started or during, is that sometimes community is also an area in which a lot of, you know, distrust has developed. And so people also given permission to be able to kind of seek out that abundance, but sometimes they might have to do it solo for a little bit of time, mm-hmm, before they build up some of the, you know, the capacity to trust that, wait a minute, like, I can put my hand out, or I can pick up the phone and call a friend, and it's safe to do so. And it's not going to kind of reinvite some of the shame language and some of the, you know, second guessing of mm-hmm, this new way of being. A program of abundance, you know, we talk about that in, like, recovery terms. It's like, rather than subtraction, it has to be with addition.
Yeah.
Because if not, it will be a scary place initially. You know, I've worked along a lot of people that have gotten clean and sober, and unless we are bumping up their systems with some fun, with some support, it doesn't last.
No.
You know, because all of a sudden, for maybe the first time in decades, they are coming into contact with really, really terrible, shitty feelings. It doesn't feel good.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, we have, like, kind of a respectful, but I think it's said in play as well, is that, you know, sometimes when people first get sober, at least in that first year to 2 years, it's kind of like a joke, right? It's kind of like, wait a minute, like, this is what I signed on for. Like, I signed up for life to get better. And what's really apparent is that things sometimes do feel worse at first, because you don't have the same numbing agents. You don't have those same, you know, kind of bids for kind of taking out that system and having to, you know, kind of navigate through and really seeing what you're made of.
And the new soothing processes generally aren't as intense and don't work as quickly.
No, because your dopaminergic system is completely hijacked for a period of time. And so, you know, when I worked in, especially in residential for, you know, recovering, drug addicts and alcoholics, they'd say, you know, Leslie, what the F do I want to do looking at the sunset? You know, that's not for me. Like I, you know, that's just not even going to give me what I need. So there's also a lot of education in our work, right? About, hey, it's going to take some time because that nervous system is going to need some time to recalibrate to what actually feels good again. You know, that it has learned and been highly reinforced to only kind of have, you know, the markers of that dopaminergic release happen in high octane activated experiences.
Right. Yeah.
You know, whether that's, you know, substance induced or whether it's even kind of a communication induced, right? Mm-hmm. Like people will at times seek out activation just to feel seen and heard, you know? So they'll seek out, you know, picking up the phone and talking to a family member that has really demonstrated that they don't have the goods to offer them. But that they'll seek it out because it's like, well, it's better than nothing. Mm-hmm. And so it's such a, the framework of like realignment comes up for me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a realigning of what feels good so that we can also start to train more of that.
Yeah.
Right. There's no healing from trauma through just kind of grind and no pain, no gain type of mentality.
Yeah. That's a great, I love that analogy because it is, your body is a finely tuned instrument. And, you know, sledgehammers aren't going to get it into shape.
No.
It's, and I don't mean physical shape. I mean becoming attuned to it and to be able to listen to it and for it to help guide you in the decisions that you make. It's, to experience joy in the little things. That to me is one of the greatest gifts of the thousands of support group meetings that I've gone to and the thousands of hours of therapy and, you know, seeing a psychiatrist and talking with, you know, fellows in the support group that is that I do sometimes get to feel joy and just, you know, maybe watching a parent interact with their kid and being present for them or the, you know, taste of a pizza or something mm-hmm. to really be able to soak it in mm-hmm. rather than, you know, gobble this moment up, kind of half paying attention and thirstily be looking for what's the next thing that's going to be intense because it's an exhausting way to live. And I still struggle with that. I still struggle with, I got to get through this thing mm-hmm. so I can experience something that I want to experience. And it's a rough way to go through life is to feel like going to the grocery store is a waste of time. My life is basically on pause while I'm getting this bullshit out of the way. And then I can come back to my house and live instead of saying, well, why don't I look for nice things when I'm at the grocery store? When I look for people that are smiling or feel grateful that I live in a country where the shelves are stocked and, right. and I can afford that. It's so hard though, sometimes.
It is. What just came up for me in listening to you is, you know, it's the, you know, kind of dirty V word. It's vulnerability. You know, being in the moment actually calls upon us to be greatly vulnerable, right? To take things in requires a pacing and a spaciousness that sometimes if we haven't had a lot of comfortability or even permission to feel things fully, the promise of chasing the next thing, of keeping yourself overscheduled and structured, of, you know, not really letting things in, that for a lot of people actually feels safer
mm-hmm.
because it doesn't require anything of us.
Right.
Right. Even though it does, right? It actually takes so much from our vitality, our life, our relationships, the depth in which things can grow and really be. But in the moment, right, we just go. We just pummel through and it's on to the next. I you know, really attribute some of kind of my most recent growing to really incorporating a daily practice of guided meditation. Mm-hmm. And I've even shared this with patients where I was doing this one course on where the invitation would be, you know, notice every time that you go from a seat to a stand or standing, you know, posture to a seat. Just notice it. You don't have to do anything with it, but just notice it. Mm-hmm. And I did this course for 3 weeks and I missed it every time.
I feel a lot better.
And I would share that because, you know, I also, you know, part of like what I really try to incorporate into the room so often as a psychotherapist is I'm human too, right? Mm-hmm. So I bring in sometimes, I weave in some of my own shortcomings, even when I'm trying to do the right thing, right? Even when I'm trying mm-hmm. to, you know, kind of, you know, garner and offer myself some spaciousness, it's like, oh, shoot, I did it again, right? I forgot. Yeah. And so it's also knowing that there's no perfect way to do this. That there's going to be times in our life where if we can really hold some intention and great awareness, and again, I'll use that term mm-hmm. orientation, where, wow, like that'll feel really rich. And then there's going to be other times. I'm a mom of two little ones, yeah. a four-year-old and a one-year-old. I'm going to be hurried, right? I'm mm-hmm. going to be flustered. I'm going to miss things. Like that is also inevitably part of this.
Yeah.
And so it's also being able to, like with our humanness, say, hey, like, that felt really awesome. And wow, like I'm going to just like really try the next time to hold some more presence, you mm-hmm. know, to hold more space. And then I'll like kind of, you know, have to, you know, remind myself of yet again, right? Those times where I step away or, mm-hmm. and that to me, as I'm saying that out loud, that is kind of that resource of our nervous system. I can notice those little, you know, kind of subtle changes. For instance, I went away on the weekend. And so as a result, you know, we were eating a lot of fast food, just a lot of, you know, kind of hurried things just to, you know, kind of, you know, pace our drive. So I felt when I returned, I couldn't wait to nourish myself and my family with, you know, good food, sustaining life energy fuel, because I could feel that my body was a little off balance. But I also don't fault myself for the burger on the side of the road.
Yeah. One of the things that really helped me was the realization that, you know, when we have the two steps forward, one step back, the way we treat ourselves when we have the one step back is often the real silver lining of that moment, that it's not a failure, that it's an opportunity to grow by looking at the way we talk to ourselves when we took that one step back. And did we use that as an opportunity to be our own best friend? Not to say that we can't learn from it and say, next time, you know, maybe I'll do this and maybe I'll have, you know, a better outcome, but to not say, you stupid piece of shit, when are you going to get this right? Everybody does it better than you, and you're never going to get where you want to get. You know, as I say often on the podcast, nobody has ever shamed themselves into being the person they want to be. And really finding a way to deal with that mean voice in your head mm-hmm. is, to me, one of the most challenging lifelong struggles, but also one of the most gratifying things when I do make headway on it. Is oh, to yeah. be nicer to myself.
Well, yeah. And you know, Peter Levine has a great interview that you can easily search. It's just Peter Levine's talk on shame. And there's a part in there in which he really talks about the fundamental biological basis for shame, right? And he gives some examples of, you know, for children, shame is indicated four times in which if there is an immediate harm or threat to their physical safety, that shame comes on to course correct immediately, that without it, we might perish in our younger years, because mm-hmm. oftentimes, like we will do some things as 2-year-olds or 3-year-olds or 5-year-olds that could potentially be dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so shame, say from like a loving parent to say, don't poke your sister in the eye. That's Peter mm-hmm. Levine's, you know, example in the film, that feeling that we get where we've messed up, right? Mm-hmm. Where we're like, oh gosh, they saw me do that. That is corrective, because then we can also pull in with repair some of the empathy, right? Gosh, hey, I'm so sorry that I raised my voice, but wow, like your sister's little. I'm thinking of even my own life right now, right? Mm-hmm. Your sister's little and she needs to make sure that she's safe too. And you need to help her with that as well. What he really differentiates is when shame becomes corrosive, in that we insert humiliation.
Right.
So when we insert in that language, you effing blink, 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 right? Like you piece of what? Right. Like
that you're stupid.
You're stupid. You're worthless. You don't even deserve to be here. You know, that type of
language. You wait until their birthday to say those things.
Well, and because what happens, and so I'm even, you know, speaking on behalf of like those individuals where if that was like their family system, right? If that's what they dealt with, we reach a point, you know, children don't have filters. So we reach a point in our lives. And also, again, a protective nature of our survival is to not be able to differentiate what is theirs and what is mine. And so over time, if that isn't interrupted with some sort of repair or offering from that caregiver or a teacher or a sibling, right, to say, hey, like, you matter, and that must have been really scary to hear those words, then we start to take that on as our own. Mm-hmm. You know, we start to believe that, wow, those things that my caregiver, the only, you know, people that I have in my life, my family, that we don't get a choice in, right? We show up sight unseen and there they are. If there's no one to, you know, intervene and make any other offering, we fall into our adult years in which we start to take on that language as our own. Yeah. And that I see in my practice a lot. Mm-hmm. And I see it fueling, you know, numbing agents, those, you know, directions in which people take our lives to take that edge off. Mm-hmm. Because that is a hostile environment to be within. Yeah. And if it's in like our own mind, then the only thing possible that we can use to escape it is something that we're ingesting.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, thank you so much for coming and explaining a lot of this stuff. And my hat is off to clinicians like you who are there on the front lines, you know, rolling up your sleeves and, you know, diving into the dark of some of these people's lives and helping them heal and make sense of their trauma and their struggles. It's we need more people like you.
I really appreciate you saying that. And you know, my last thing on that is, you know, there's such a human element and a necessity to be human in a room as a psychotherapist. And so, yes, you're absolutely right. Like, we are marching into some of the depths of, you know, discoveries and, you know, disclosures that aren't really witnessed elsewhere. But it also is such an invitation to remember that we all have our dark sides too. You know, like we're not unique in that, right? We're human as well. And so there's so much healing that can happen by the permission granted of being able to be in a room with another person or a group of people and to say, gosh, like, wow, like I feel your pain. Like I've been through, you know, something completely different. The details and the context don't matter, but wow, like I have empathy for this because I get it. I'm human. Yeah.
If people want to know more about you, where can they find info or contact you?
So they can find, the easiest way would probably be just to go to our website. So LidoWellnessCenter.com. So we're located down in Newport Beach in the beautiful Lido Village, and it's LIDO. And that's probably the easiest way. It's got all of our contact information. It's the most direct route in order to, you know, get near me, whether it's through maybe, you know, wanting to see what our program is all about, or even wanting to maybe, you know, work with me in private practice. That's a great place to start.
And if people want to investigate somatic experiencing, they can read the book Waking the Tiger by Peter Levine. But what if they want to find a practitioner near them?
So that a great place to start. Now, truth be told, and I'll say this just as a disclaimer, and I hope I don't, you know, madden any of my fellow SE folks. The directory currently on their website, traumahealing.org, can be a little tricky to utilize. Sometimes some of their search filters are a little tricky, but it is a great place to start. A lot of us as somatic practitioners are listed there. It also will have, you know, kind of a whole biography just about what are some of the areas in which they specialize more. Mm-hmm. A lot of practitioners will also indicate whether they do body work or touch work, or if they're, you know, kind of more traditionally licensed, you know, psychotherapists where they might just do more talk oriented services. So traumahealing.org is a great place to find, you know, the SE directory, but also it has great, you know, videos, research, you know, just some language to really kind of get you started in your familiarity with SE.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Love that. Love it. I love when I can get an interview with somebody that exposes listeners or me to something new that can be helpful. I love that feeling. This episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. Just imagine that you're at the vet and you get a bill, or they say, well, to do this operation on your dog, it's going to cost such and such, and you love your dog or your cat, and you don't have the money to pay it, and you have to make that
very, very difficult decision. Well, the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/mental. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/mental. One more time, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/mental. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by Monsters Adden Sony. She writes about her anxiety. The world has ended several hundred times throughout my life, and I've died and come back to life at least that many times. About her OCD, my internal world was my safe haven when I was little. Now the door hinge is rusty and the light is flickering. I need to change the bulb. When I do, it burns out as soon as I look away. About compulsive behaviors, she writes, sometimes I wonder if I convinced myself into having psychosis. I'm such a perfectionist, I even want to be the best at being mentally ill. Thank you for those. This is from the Shame and Secret survey filled out by Invisigirl, and she identifies as straight. She's in her 40s, was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment, according to her. Was a victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. Both of my parents treated my teenaged body inappropriately. My mother both shamed me for having breasts and then would take me lingerie shopping so my boyfriend would get a, quote, treat at 15. My father made overt sexual comments in public about my body and later, when he was drunk nightly, would call me a slut. I've been violently raped, but the actions of my family was far more damaging. She's been physically and emotionally abused. This is intense. Last year, my husband of 15 years broke 7 of my ribs in 12 places. I had to drive myself to the hospital because it was Remembrance Day. I'm Canadian. And as he's a vet, was drinking at the Legion. I was told I should have had a metal plate put in my chest, but there wasn't enough solid bone to fix it to. I left him when I was discharged a week later, and he has convinced everyone that he's the poor victim with PTSD and a mean wife. I have lupus and am quite ill and on a high dose of steroid, which causes weight gain. He repeatedly makes jokes in public about how fat I am. So I'm 5'6", 130 pounds, so I'm hardly a beast, but he knew that the extra weight could make me insecure and would take a shot whenever he could. Any positive experiences? I have many happy memories with my ex-husband. I stayed far too long because he used to be a kind, gentle man. Darkest thoughts. I imagine duct taping him to a chair, and while explaining the hurt he has caused to me and our sons, cutting off fingers and toes with garden shears. Every time he is arrogant or dismissive, snip. Question, though, are you going to wear those gardening gloves and the knee pads? Because when you're working on the toes, you don't want to hurt your back. You got to get down there. Darkest secrets, I've taken medication that did not belong to me. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. I haven't been touched in a loving way in 3 years. I'm just lonely. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I'm financially dependent on people who are mean to me. I'd like to tell them they are terrible humans and to fuck right off. What, if anything, do you wish for? Peace, good health, financial stability, and a loving man to read in bed with at night. Have you shared these things with others? Not really. I'm pretty isolated. How do you feel after writing these things down? Glad I still have beer in the fridge. Anything you'd like to share with someone in the dark who shares your thoughts or experiences? In the dark moments, hang on to the strength you have already shown. Grit your teeth and hang on until tomorrow. And I would add, and reach out for help. Create a community of support, because we need it, man. When the darkness is upon us and reality is being distorted, or even not distorted sometimes, you know, even when we see things clearly, we cannot see clearly that we could benefit from some support. Thank you for that survey. And high fucking five on making him your ex. This is a struggle in a sentence filled out by Sick in a Good Way. And she describes a snapshot from her life. I woke up in a bad mood today, but I'm determined to hold on to healthy coping mechanisms until it passes. I even pack a lunch, but I force myself to work a long day at the office. So productive. And then I skip my workout because I'm home late. And then I have a couple drinks. Finally, alone and buzzed at the end of the night, I dig my sharp scissors out of the drawer, cut myself, and feel the tension drain out of my body. For the first time today, the world has come sharply into focus, and I feel relief. No one would ever guess. They think I have it all under control. Thank you for sharing that. That is heavy. That is heavy. I know a lot of people struggle with that, and it's a very, very misunderstood, I don't know if you call it addiction, coping mechanism, whatever you want to call it, but a lot of people think that oh, they're doing it for attention, and no, they're doing it because they're in pain. I'm not saying nobody's ever done it for attention, but it just bugs me when people don't consider the fact that somebody's doing it because they're in pain. This is a shame and secret survey filled out by Smokey. He identifies as straight. He's in his 40s, was raised in a slightly dysfunctional environment, was the victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. I was 7 when I was raped anally and forced to perform oral sex with an older teen. I believe it lasted the whole summer. He's been physically abused. My mom had a boyfriend that looked for any excuse to beat my brother and I. He would make us stand in the corner on our knees and stretch as high as we could with our arms in the air. Any positive experiences with the abusers? I like to be creepy and look at other women and fantasize. I don't know. I think he filled that out. I think that was meant for another section of the survey. Darkest thoughts. I'm not afraid of dying. Darkest secrets. I like to look at porn, Asian women mostly. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. Video sex. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I'm sorry to my children. I was never a good father to them. What, if anything, do you wish for? Peace. Have you shared these things with others? No, no one. Too ashamed. How do you feel after writing these things down? Better. Anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? Get help. Talk to someone. Thank you for that, man. And that might have been one of the briefest surveys I've ever read. And you are the Ernest Hemingway of survey fills. And I just want to send you some love, man. weren't a lot of words in that, but you got a lot of it across to me. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey. Actually, you know what? Let's inject some loves into this. A listener named Rebecca filled out a huge page of loves, and so I'm just going to inject them here and there throughout the podcast. I love watching people decorate cakes with buttercream and sprinkles. I love feeling the low ache in my knees right before my period. That is an odd one. I've never heard somebody say that they love an ache. I love the feeling of seeing the stencil of sunlight on my wooden floor. I love seeing beams of light through red leaves on the trees. I love walking through a field at dusk, smelling the ground as it meets the moist chill of the air. Oh, that is a great one. And it's such a subtle one. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence, filled out by a woman who calls herself Princess Jasmine. And about her ADD, she writes, feeling hopeless after hearing over and over again how smart and capable I would be if I just, quote, tried a little harder. About her anxiety, suddenly becoming extremely aware of my breath and pulse and feeling like I will almost certainly die. Snapshot from her life. Being asexual, struggling with an avoidant attachment, and having ADHD makes having romantic relationships extremely difficult. I've been on countless Tinder dates just to remind myself that guys think I'm attractive, but every time they want any sort of physical intimacy, I find some excuse to end the date early. Now that I finally have a boyfriend who is patient and respects my boundaries, I still can't hold his hand without feeling overwhelmingly anxious. I feel guilty that I don't know if I'll ever be able to give him the physical intimacy he wants from me. Thank you for sharing that. That has got to be, you know, while I know what it's like to have a fear of intimacy and dread around sex, I can't imagine what it's like to feel overwhelmed just by holding someone's hand. Sending you some love and good vibes. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a guy who calls himself Skittles and Schlitz. He's got to be from Milwaukee. He writes, I wonder if that guy I kind of sort of know would have sent that LinkedIn invite yesterday if he knew how many times I thought about bending his girlfriend over my couch. I appreciate the honesty. And who knows, maybe that's why he sent the LinkedIn invite. This is from the racism survey. And this was filled out by a woman who was filling this out as if it were her 4.5-year-old child. So this is supposed to be from the perspective of her child, but it's her filling it out. And he is of German, Austrian, and Pakistani descent. And she writes, my mom is filling out this survey for me without my knowledge as I am only 4.5 years old. I am living in Western Europe. My mom is German, Austrian, and my dad is Pakistani. I can see it in my face. At kindergarten, I was the last one to leave the room when a native, white-skinned, blue-eyed classmate of age 5 hit me on the head. Then he forcefully shut the door in front of me and pushed against it. He yelled at me, "You're a stranger. You are bad. You don't belong to us." On another occasion, the same boy has insulted my appearance, and I had episodes where I wished I had white skin and blue eyes. Do you remember how you felt when it happened? In shock, confused, sad, alone. How do you feel about it now? My mom, who is filling out this survey, can guess that I put this experience aside to some degree because the caretakers around were compassionate and supportive. However, my mom and dad are worried that it had left scars in the soul as they themselves had been targeted by racism and xenophobia early in life. Wow. Thank God he has support around him, but I can't imagine the scar that leaves, especially when someone's brain is in its most formative year, years, months. I hate when I make mistakes. This is from the Shame and Secret survey filled out by a woman who calls herself We Feel Bad in Sweden Too. She identifies as straight. She's in her 20s, was raised in a totally chaotic environment, was the victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. My mom had insane boundary issues. She would walk around naked, masturbate, and have sex so we could hear and or see it. I was probably raped by two guys I knew while drunk. Twice people have had sex with me while I was sleeping, and some more stuff. I now have so much shame about not respecting myself that I cannot enjoy sex and I have to be drunk so I can pretend. I so badly want someone to love me, but all my issues always make people leave. She's been physically and emotionally abused. My mother was incredibly abusive. She hated me and my siblings, but I'm the oldest and she hates me the most. She gave me anorexia and bulimia with her constant telling me I am ugly. It was always just chaos around her. She broke our, quote, family into pieces. My siblings have drug problems so bad that I don't know where my sister is or even if she is still alive. Nobody cares about us. Our dad doesn't at all. I haven't spoken to my mom in about 5 years, but 20 years of her telling me and showing me that I'm worthless and bad to the core has left me a broken person. Any positive experiences with the abusers? It's like people always say, she is still your mother, and I guess there is some level of truth to that. I mean, she was nice when people were looking. Well, that's a narcissist. That's an abusive narcissist. You know, there's that saying, you know, how do you act when no one's looking? Man, that is a lot. Darkest thoughts, that she was right all along. Nobody could ever love somebody like me, and I should just give up and kill myself already. Darkest secrets. I do so many things to keep the pain at bay and to seem normal. I can't even keep track anymore. Anything to numb it, which usually means having sex with people who are abusive to me, drinking a lot, taking drugs, not eating or eating too much, all to be able to go through life without people noticing how bad things really are. I think something that would be good to start things off would be to stop drinking and stop taking drugs. And if you can't do that on your own, to reach out for help, because it's really, really hard to heal emotional wounds when we're still in an active addiction. And the support for addictions can also help heal the wounds. Sexual fantasy is most powerful to you. BDSM, and it makes me feel awful because I know it comes from a place where I can't handle love or gentle sex but feel right at home if I'm forced and degraded. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I want to say I'm sorry to a lot of people who tried to do right by me, but it just blew up in everyone's faces. I just wanted to be loved, but I keep messing it up. Please be patient. To my parents, I just want to ask them why. Why put three people into the world just to ruin their prospects of having any kind of healthy life? What, if anything, do you wish for? I wish that someone would save me. Maybe a cult leader. I always somehow felt that that could be good. I'm so tired of thinking for myself. And in parentheses, that was the famous Swedish humor. Have you shared these things with others? I usually have to tell people at some point where my family are, why I'm all alone. They usually say I'm very strong and should be proud. Some people cry. I don't like that. But almost everybody that at some point felt sorry for me got angry if my problem somehow interferes with their life. People always understand when it's easy, but have very little understanding during bad or dark periods. How do you feel after writing these things down? A little lighter, I must say, exclamation point. Is there anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? Nobody's perfect. We still haven't killed any puppies or stole candy from small children. How could we be the worst? Question mark. I love when I get a survey, especially like this one, not because of the pain, but because they're reaching out and they're opening up and they feel lighter afterwards. But I really love it when I get it from, you know, part of the world that I've never even been to. This is from the racism survey filled out by LZ, and she's Asian American. And she writes, when I was 13 in 2005, I moved from a very diverse middle school to a predominantly white high school in a much wealthier neighborhood in Westchester, New York, my freshman year. On my first day, I walked into homeroom and noticed that almost all the other kids were white, but I guess I didn't think much of it at the time because they looked like what I saw in high school movies growing up. I sat next to the only other Asian girl, I'm Filipino, by the way, in the class to say hi, and she immediately got up and sat with a group of white kids. Not too long afterward, I realized that no one wanted anything to do with me or that handful of other people of color kids. I was pretty much ignored my entire high school experience, and literally any time someone said something to me, it was racist. A lot of the kids, and I think even some of the white teachers, assumed I didn't speak English well and spoke to me super slowly. I was even placed in classes a grade lower than me, even though I was smart as hell. Do you remember how you felt when it happened? Instead of feeling hurt right away, I was mostly confused because I didn't understand why I was being treated that way. At my old school, I was friends with everyone and we all accepted each other's differences. I went from feeling loved and confident to thinking I was weird, ugly, and like I did not belong. I just wanted to get the fuck out of there and for it to all be over. How do you feel about it now? Looking back now, I feel angry and wish I had it in me then to speak up and tell everyone to go fuck themselves. I wish I would have stuck up for myself and the other kids who'd had hurtful things said to them. I recently learned that high school is where I taught myself how to dissociate because I was so fucking miserable. And 15 years later, I'm struggling so hard to snap out of it. Any thoughts or feelings you'd like to share? Although I feel angry, it definitely made me a more empathetic person. Thank you for that. Thank you so much for that. And that is not the first time I have read a survey about somebody in school just because they looked like, you know, they were Asian or some other ethnicity, were talked down to by teachers as if they didn't know how to speak English. A couple more loves from Rebecca. I love watching people paddle on the river. I love when my pace is in sync with crosswalk signals. Oh, that's a great one. I love seeing the dirt get sucked up by my vacuum. Bonus points if I can feel and hear the crunch and crackle of the debris. That is a great one. I love the heat and squeaky dryness of dinner plates as I pull them from the dishwasher. Oh, man, you have got a poetic streak, Rebecca. And then finally, this is from What's My Name Again? Who identifies as agender, and they give us a snapshot from their life. I used to go to the top of a 15-story parking garage and sit with my legs dangling over the side so I could talk myself out of jumping. Though no one ever noticed or tried to stop me, I always got myself back down the stairs alone. And as difficult as it was, I'm glad I've stuck around. Flash forward a few months. A date I was on took me to the top of that same parking garage so we could look at the city lights. We were hugging and laughing and playing in the snow that had gathered around the cars, and I took a moment to watch my breath coming in and out of my lungs in the cold air. I was glad to still be breathing, and glad she was with me. We stopped to share a long kiss. Suddenly a man's voice was yelling, "Hey, you can't be up here!" The one of a dozen rooftop visits that I actually enjoyed, and of course it was the night that the security guard actually paid attention. He chased us out with his flashlight, and we ran giggling like teenagers. Oh, so awesome. So awesome. I love when the universe just gives us a hug. I don't know what other word for it, but I love those moments when you feel like, no, this is not coincidence. This is some force in the universe telling me to hang in there. And I hope you enjoyed our episode, our interview, our surveys. And just remember, if you're out there and you're feeling stuck, you are most definitely not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.